of details. For NPR News, I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner says he has reassured China that the United States will take steps to address rising budget deficits once the economic recovery is firmly in place. China has huge investments in the United States and has worried that it could be undermined by U.S. budget deficits. Geithner says the Obama administration plans to reverse the spending of hundreds of billions of dollars devoted to stimulating the economy and propping up a teetering financial system. The secretary says the Chinese agreed to take steps to increase domestic consumption of its products. 2 days of high-level talks between Chinese envoys and U.S. officials ended yesterday. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. The following is a required weekly test of the emergency alert system. This has been a test of the emergency alert system. This is WILL Urbana.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, we're reaching into the archives for the programs, one from earlier this month and one from the beginning of June. So as you listen, do keep in mind that today, both hours, will not be taking calls. This first hour, first broadcast on June 9th. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about recent Russian history, and specifically about the life of one individual. Now, although it was Mikhail Gorbachev who was responsible for the decline of the Communist Party, it was Boris Yeltsin who was the first elected leader in the long history of Russia. It was Yeltsin who buried the Soviet Union itself. Even after his death in 2007, he remains the most controversial figure in recent Russian history. This morning, in this hour of the program, we'll explore why and how Yeltsin broke with single-party rule. Well, that is not the program that we had planned to play in this hour, so I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to switch things around. We're going to play the what would be the 11 o'clock hour, and then we'll see if we can go and rescue the show from hour number one. At any rate, this is a program about populism in America, and this is a show we first broadcast, we hope, on July 9th. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about populism in American politics. The populist impulse in America has often been dismissed as backward and anti-modern. However, our guest for this hour of the program, historian Charles Postol, says, well, that's not true. Certainly it is not true of the populists of the late 19th century in America. He says these were thinking modern people who had an alternative vision of what America should look like. This morning, we'll be talking about how populists in the 19th century thought about things like business and race and technology and women's rights, and perhaps also how they and their agenda, their issues, influenced progressives in the early 20th century. He's the author of a book that explores this territory. The title of his book is The Populist Vision. It is available now in paperback, published by the Oxford University Press. It's a book that was first published in 2007 and received a couple of major prizes, the Bancroft Prize in 2008, and also the Organization of American Historians Frederick Jackson Turner Award. Our guest, Charles Postol, is assistant professor at San Francisco State University. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Postol, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Something that I think probably we should do at the beginning, I should ask you to do, because we do use the term populist pretty loosely, is to talk about the distinction between populist with a small p, the way we use it now, and populism with the capital P that you're talking about here as it existed in the late 1800s.
Right. Well, today you can't turn on the news without hearing about some kind of populist. And I think today we use populism with a small p to talk about two categories of things, and they're related but not the same. And one of those is sort of the the outraged Joe Sixpack, who is angry about government and angry about the way the country is going, and sort of spins the news cycle on cable news, and generally his main targets is fear of government and fear of taxation. And that's one type of small-p populist we see today. And the other thing that's being called populist rage or populist anger is just a general questioning or citizens questioning the corporate establishment, which has run the economy off the cliff. And people are, and you can't open a newspaper without seeing that also being described as some type of populist anger or populist rage. I'm not sure that either of these have too much to do with populism with a capital P, which was the original populist movement of the 1880s and 1890s. In the early 1890s, a coalition of farmer, labor, and middle-class movements, or form movements, combined into a political party. It was called, at the time, the People's Party. And its nickname was the Populist Party. It was known, so it's interchangeable, People's Party or Populist Party. That's where we get the expression populist. And this was a highly successful third-party movement, the most successful third-party movement since the American Civil War. And it shook up America, and in many ways created what is modern America, and had an important role to play.
Mm-hmm.
So that's populism with a small p and populism with a capital P.
And I'm sure we'll talk some more about this, but certainly they did have some electoral successes, and perhaps if you ask the question, were they successful, the answer is yes, in the sense that the major parties, the Republicans and Democrats, looked at portions of the populist agenda and ended up adopting those things. So if the question is, did some of what they wanted to happen, the answer is yes.
Right. They did have a number of important electoral successes. They sent congressmen and senators to Washington, not very many, but they took over state government in states as varied as Colorado and North Carolina, or North Carolina. They shared power with the Republicans. They took over the state government in Kansas. But what the most important thing is that both Republicans and Democrats in many states learned that they needed to get a chunk of the populist vote to win, and took over sections of the populist program. So whether it's the income tax or women's rights or a whole variety of reforms advocated by the populists, that process, that how those reforms came into the Democratic and Republican Party was in that period.
Mm-hmm. I think that this time in American history, roughly speaking, the second half of the 19th century, and really you're dealing with a little bit later, so the later half of the 19th century, I think is one of the more interesting times in American history. And maybe the reason that it is that the kind of things that people were concerned about so closely parallel the things that we're still concerned about, as you write about in the book. People were concerned about new and emerging technologies, particularly communications technologies. People were concerned about corporate power. People were concerned about globalization. It sounds very much like the same list of concerns that we have right now.
I couldn't agree more. That's what brought me to it, and I think it's a great source to look back at how people have dealt with very similar things in a different period in our history.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, and again, we can talk some more about this, but that you really want people to understand that the populists, the capital P populists of this time, were people who, it sounds like they were pragmatic, they were progressive, but I don't know if you would say that they were revolutionary.
Yes, I think your characterization is right. They would not have called themselves revolutionary in the sense of overthrow of the capitalist system. Sometimes you'd hear people like Tom Watson, "We want a revolution," but it's what they're talking about. What we would talk about is they're reforming capitalism. They want capitalism to work better. They want capitalism to be more humane and more just. And they have a system of what they considered pragmatic reforms to make capitalism better.
Well, right here in the introduction of the book, you write that our historical understanding of what the populace thought, it's largely drawn from what they protested. What did they protest?
Well, when you read our textbooks in high school about populism, you know that they protested the railway corporations, they protested the banks, they didn't like the corruption of state legislatures by the banking and railroad corporations. Those are the type of things that you learn that they didn't like, and from that we frequently draw inaccurate conclusions about what they were for.
Well, that does, I think, go to this notion, and you certainly write about it in the book, and perhaps this reflects what people think about when they hear that populist, that they were, in a sense, anti-technological, anti-modern, anti-progress.
Right.
And which you're arguing is not the case, but that's what people think. And, in fact, there's probably been a fair amount of scholarship devoted to that kind of analysis. So that gets at the question, well, why is it you think that these people for such a long time were so badly misunderstood?
Well, even at the time, their critics would say that they were opposed to modern development. Modern development requires the gold standard, for example, where the populace, of course, advocated a flexible currency. We have a flexible currency today, regulated by the Federal Reserve. They advocated a flexible currency regulated by the federal government. The corporate and university establishment, academic establishment in those days, thought that a flexible currency was insane, that going off the gold standard would destroy civilization. And they would argue that the populist proposal was meant the destruction of modern life, that they were anti-modern. And that's how they argued in the 1890s, that any alternative to the corporate model or the corporate establishment was anti-modern. And I think that there are parallels to the present that are very striking. If you look at when Congress was deliberating the destruction of the New Deal regulations of the banking industry in 1999, when Congress was repealing the Glass-Steagall Act that had, for decades, had made sure that banking stayed on a relatively stable course, they called it the Financial Services Modernization Act of 1999, because their model of deregulated, unfettered capitalism was supposedly more modern than regulated capitalism. So this type of epithet that people who are opposed to a particular model of corporate development has been around for a long time. And so, for example, if you criticize a certain type of international trade pact, NAFTA, for example, you're supposed to be anti-modern. And the populists received the exact same treatment back in the 1890s.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Charles Postol. He is assistant professor at San Francisco State University and is the author of the book, The Populist Vision. It is a book that won a couple of major prizes, including the Bancroft Prize, and just fairly recently has been published in paperback by the Oxford University Press. So if you're interested in looking at it, you can seek out the book. Questions are welcome here on the program. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign Urbana listeners. We do also have that toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere you're listening. If it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. I'm sure that when people think about populism, particularly people think about populism at this time, before 1900, they think of a movement that is rural and agrarian by its nature and its base. And I think that it is true that perhaps that's where this starts. What was going on now at that point that led to this movement? And as, I mean, specifically in farm communities across the country.
Well, I do want to get back to a misconception that it was an exclusively rural or agrarian movement, especially to your listeners in Illinois, where it was largely, yes, there were the Southern Illinois farmers were very involved in this. The Farmers Mutual Benefit Association in Illinois was a key player in the populist coalition, but so were the coal miners, so were the railway workers of Illinois, and so were the citizens of Chicago. This was a broad class coalition in much of the Midwest. It was mainly a labor movement and an urban movement. So we could get back to that.
Sure, sure.
But in terms of farmers had a series of major grievances. And I touched on one earlier, but this was a period when farm prices were broadly declining. There was a period of what's called a general depression of the 1890s when all prices are falling, but especially farm prices. And the response to this was they had several responses. And one of the things that farmers wanted was inflation. They wanted to inflate the currency. Now, we, in our modern culture, we think of inflation as just universally bad. But if you think about it more closely, inflation is good for some people and bad for other people. If you're a farmer, inflation could do some very good things. Not uncontrolled inflation, but a certain amount of inflation in the economy means that the bushel of wheat or corn you grow, the value of that goes up, or the price of that goes up in the market. The cost of your mortgage on your farm or your farm machinery goes down. We don't think about it today, but if you have a fixed rate mortgage, if you're lucky to have a fixed rate mortgage today, and there's a little inflation, that takes the sting out of the price of that mortgage. Well, that's exactly what they wanted. They wanted some inflation for those purposes. The other thing is, in the depression of the 1890s, and this is something that I think quite relevant to today, farmers believed that the general price decline was a source of the depression, that in order to get out, and in fact, that's what they called the depression in those days. That's where the word comes from. A general decline in prices is what a depression means. And to relieve that, to stimulate the economy by expanding the currency, was just what the doctor ordered. And you might think of Obama's stimulus bill as something the populace would have said, yes, that's just what we need to lift the economy out of the rut. So that's one of the things the farmers were after. There was also an issue of frozen credit markets. We talk a lot about frozen credit markets today when banks aren't doing the lending. But in much of rural America in the 1880s and 1890s, there simply was no availability of credit. And when they could get credit, it could be very expensive. And so the populace proposed, they had a proposal that was called the sub-treasury plan. And the sub-treasury plan would centralize rural credit in Washington and allow farmers to take out loans on their crops at a 2% rate. So the federal government would set up warehouses in every agricultural community in America, and the federal government would give farmers loans on those crops, and on that basis, the farmers could cut out speculation in the rural economy and receive credit so that they could carry out their farming. So those are two very large issues. They're also concerned about railroad rates, and we can talk about that further, but they wanted nationalization of railroads so that they could get a better rate to get their crops to market.
I want to have you talk about farmers' alliance groups. There was a, in terms of organizing organizations, there was a National Farmers Alliance. There were state groups.
Yes.
What sort of role did they play?
Well, to understand the populist movement or the populist party, it wasn't a traditional party. It was really what they called at the time a confederation of industrial orders, which was a coalition of different reform movements. And the biggest ones and the most important ones were the farmers' alliances. Now, there was a Southern Farmers Alliance, which is the largest of them all. There was a Northern Farmers Alliance centered in Chicago, which was important in the upper Midwest. There was also the Farmers Mutual Benefit Association, which is centered in southern Illinois, which actually played a much bigger role than most people are aware of. And these associations were originally sort of business associations of farmers trying to combine in order to get a better place in the markets, to regulate farm commodities, to bring credit into rural areas. They're really high-powered business associations of farmers in the South, in the West, in the Midwest, and that is really the foundation of the People's Party. Now, what they actually did more than anything else was educational campaigns. It was one way to think of the Farmers Alliance movement or the farmers movement in those days as a vast rural university to study problems of economics, finance. They wanted to know how this new economy, this new globalized, centralized, dynamic economy worked. Not to reject that economy, but to make it work for the ordinary person. And so they said, we need to study it. If we're going to make this system work for us, we need to control the levers of this economy, and we can't do that unless we understand how it works. Mm. So hundreds of thousands, millions of farmers came off their farmsteads to go into their meeting lodges to discuss how taxes worked, why a progressive income tax is better than what existed, why we need to reform the financial structure, well, the pros and cons of inflation. These are the kinds of things they discussed, as well as history and science, technology, problems of the world. That's really what this movement was about. It wasn't about sharpened pitchforks, as you might read in today's newspapers or see on the television. It was about deliberate discussion and research about how the economy worked, how the society worked.
We're just about at our midpoint here. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. We're glad that you're tuned in today. Also pleased to have as our guest in this hour Charles Postol. He's an historian. He's assistant professor of history at San Francisco State University. He is the author of the book The Populist Vision. It was first published in 2007, won the Bancroft Prize, also the Organization of American Historians Frederick Jackson Turner Award. It is now available in paperbacks published by the Oxford University Press, and looks at the history of the Populist Party, that is with a capital P, in late 19th century, and also perhaps how it influenced progressives in the 20th century. All of this is in the book, and if you'd like to read more about it, you can seek it out. Questions, too, are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. A little bit earlier when I asked you to talk about the involvement of farmers in populism, you said that you again wanted to make sure that you got it, the misconception that populism was simply an urban and agrarian kind of movement, and that in fact it was also an urban and a labor movement as well. It involved people like coal miners, for example. Talk about now this other facet of the movement.
Well, it's important to keep in mind that the populist coalition was never successful in the Northeast for a variety of reasons, but in the rest of the country, it was a very successful third party movement, as third parties go, and a lot of it was coal miners and railway workers, which was two of the most dynamic sections of the labor movement in that epoch, were attracted to the populists. The populists offered reforms that the 8-hour day and other reforms that workers sought, regulation of the railroads and regulation of the mining industry. It was also played an important role among middle class activists in cities like Chicago or San Francisco or Denver, where activists looked to the populace as a vehicle of progressive reform, public ownership of the local streetcars, public education systems. People looked to the populace as a means of reforming and improving society. And so men like Clarence Darrow was a populist. I don't know if your readers or listeners are all aware of Clarence Darrow, but he, of course, is the iconoclastic Chicago lawyer, very urbane, skeptical. But he threw his weight in behind the populace for the type of reforms he sought. So that is something important to keep in mind.
So how does all this come together in the formation of the People's Party? So here, again, as you explained, populism, we get that term from the People's Party. It was a political party, one of the most successful, or perhaps you said it was the most successful third party in America ever. How does all this come together to form this party?
Well, just a point of clarification, the most successful third party ever was the Republican Party of the 1850s.
Since then,
it's the populists. The Republicans actually became a major party, which the populists faded. I think your question is that, for example, in Illinois, the Farmers Association, which was known as the Farmers Mutual Benefit Association, and the other farmers groups negotiated with the coal miners, with the urban reformers, the single taxers, the socialists, and other groups in Chicago, and put forward a platform. We are going to enter politics in the 1890s on this basis as a coalition. So it was coalition politics at its very best, and briefly very successful.
And they did run a candidate for President of the United States in... what year was this? 1896.
Well, they ran a candidate in 1892. That was when it was a brand new party. It had just formed, and they ran James Weaver as president, and he got over something like a million votes or something like that. It was a good start for a new brand new party. 1896, things got tough because at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, William Jennings Bryan, who is a young congressman from Nebraska, captured the nomination with a stirring speech about the cross of gold. And he was a reformer, a great orator. He captures the Democratic nomination in 1896. And this strengthens the reform wing of the Democratic Party, the Western and Southern reform wing of the Democratic Party. So what are the populists going to do about this? Bryan, for example, is for inflating the currency with the coinage of silver. The populists want that too. Are they going to support Bryan, or are they going to run an independent candidate? And the populists split on this issue. Some populists said, no, we have to support Bryan. Some populists said, no, we need to maintain our independence for the full populist platform. The end result was that the main leadership of the Populist Party did endorse Bryan's campaign. There was a very fractious conflict over this issue. But the net result was that the populists never regained their strength after that. And what does happen, though, is that the Democrats take over much of the populist demands. And interestingly, in especially in the West, in the Midwest, many Republicans also have to take over populist demands to win elections. So that's sort of the outcome. Hmm.
A number of the people who were important in the populist party and the populist movement were women. And I'd like to have you talk about how it is that populists thought about women, women's rights, their participation in politics.
Well, rural populists were very concerned about the fate of women on these lonely farmsteads and campaigned vigorously that women should have access to schools, access to higher education, should have access to better implements at home, whether it was more modern facilities in their kitchens. They wanted a more modern life for rural women. Most populists, especially in the Midwest and West, were also in the very forefront of campaigning for women's suffrage. So in many ways, this was a women's movement. People have notice that there was no movement that mobilized as many women in American history outside of the churches besides the populist movement. So it was a great women's mobilization. Hundreds of thousands of women took part in this movement, engaged in this movement. We don't think of it as a women's movement, but I think it's important to think of it as this was the women's movement in its rural context. Now, a key issue was suffrage for many women. And in states like Colorado, for example, where the populists take over the state house, that's when women gain the vote. And so the populists were in the very forefront of women gaining the vote, not everywhere, but in key states. And that's an important thing to think about when we think of populist reform.
What about the African Americans and their place in both in the party and in politics?
That is a complex question historians have struggled to grapple with. We would like to think that the populists were something of a break from the very dismal politics of white supremacy and segregation that dominated the American political scene in the 1880s and 90s. I'm not sure that it really works that way. The populists wanted to be modern. They wanted progressive reforms, what they called progressive reforms of the modern businessman. And in the rural South, for that matter, in the whole South, which was where 90% of African Americans lived in that epoch, the populace agreed, the white populace basically agreed with the white Democrats who controlled the South at that time, that segregation and white supremacy are the future. Now we usually think of them as backward and in the past, but both Democrats and populists agreed that there was something, that the modern business model was a segregated model based on white power. It's hard for us to think of it in those terms, but that's how it was conceived at that time. And so populist legislators, the Farmers Alliance-influenced legislators, initiated some of the key segregation laws in the South, segregating the railroads, for example. And there was almost no white populists who advocated that black people should have positions of authority in society and holding public office. One other thing we have to think about, though, is that in this epoch, blacks have yet to lose the vote. Black men are still voting in large numbers. This would end by the turn of the century, but in the 1880s and 90s, they're still voting. And when the Democrats and the populace started to slug it out at the polls, they both had to appeal to black voters to win. And that's how they understood it. So you have some very interesting politics of white populace appealing to black farmers on common economic interests. And this is very advantageous to black people to have this type of competition between what were really the two white supremacist parties in the South. And so that was an important opening. That opening is slammed shut by the turn of the century when blacks are broadly disfranchised and driven from the polls. So that's sort of the end of that story. But it did provide an opening in the South. There were other things in the rest of the country that were interesting, which probably don't deserve a great deal of detail, but there were eddies of racial tolerance and opening among the populace in the West and elsewhere, where they did break the color line and did make appeals to not only tolerance towards blacks, but also towards Native Americans and Mexican Americans and even Asian Americans or Chinese.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Others who are listening are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. This caller is in Urbana, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Let me raise two other issues or possible factors in populism. One is the Anti-Saloon League and the Prohibition Movement of the 1890s. You might recall the book In His Steps and so on. To what extent was that a factor in populism of the time? And second, the charge often raised to discredit the populace is anti-Semitism. To what extent was that a factor? I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right.
Excellent questions. Anti-Saloon League. The populace, I think that the great majority of populace probably did sympathize with Prohibition. But the issue was that they knew that that could kill them at the polls. German voters, other immigrant groups, simply were not going to vote for a reform party that's going to take away their beer. That's how they understood it. That's how it was discussed at that time. So the populace generally refrained from public endorsements of Prohibition, and they were generally separated from the Prohibition Party or other temperance campaigns. Even though there were important crossover for that brief period in the 1890s, they tended to remain separate. On the anti-Semitism issue, this is a very complicated thing. In the 1950s, Richard Hofstadter, the very important historian from Columbia University, wrote a very major work, the Age of Reform, won the Pulitzer Prize, still very influential, that basically describes populism as a backward-looking anti-Semitic movement. Really, it's sort of the prototype of what might become an American fascism, is one way to think of how that Hofstadter and other historians in the 1950s treated the populace. The problem with that is that if you look at populist literature, and if you look at the way populists discuss Jews and the Jews or the question of anti-Semitism, they actually come off looking pretty good compared to, say, the academics at Yale or Harvard or the other major figures in American cultural life. They did have a tendency to use the expression Shylock to represent bankers or the corporate elite, but mainly bankers. And that was a clearly anti-Semitic metaphor. However, if you read their literature, it's almost universally metaphorical. It's not for attacks against actual Jews or Jewry. It's that there's something Jewish about bankers, which is a metaphoric treatment. And this is very different than, say, how the populace, at least in the South, dealt with African Americans, where they are actually in favor of measures against black people. There's no such thing as populist proposals for measures against Jews. They didn't actually, there's almost no discussion of actual Jews in their literature or their politics, which actually separates them from many in the academic or corporate elite. So I hope that helps.
All right. We're heading into about our last 10 minutes here in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Charles Postol. He is assistant professor of history at San Francisco State University. We're talking about populism in 19th century America. This is the subject of his book, The Populist Vision. It was first published in 2007 and is now available in a paperback edition. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Won the Bancroft Prize in 2008. You might want to take a look at it. Questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about one of the interesting things here being that the concerns of the populists, what they thought about, talked about, debated, how much they reflected some of our concerns of today. They were interested in technology and how it changed life. They were concerned about corporate power. They were concerned about income inequality and the big spread between the wealthy and the poor. They were concerned with globalization.
Something else that they also were interested in, and this was a matter of debate at the time, was something like the science-religion kind of debate that we're having right now. You talked earlier about the fact that Clarence Darrow was well-known as a populist, and if people know anything about him, they probably know about his involvement in the Scopes trial. And it seems that those are issues that we haven't stopped debating.
The Scopes trial is way when I tell people I work on populism, people often say, "Oh, the Scopes trial," and what they mean by that, of course, John Scopes was up on trial in Dayton, Tennessee, for teaching evolution. And what they mean, the Scopes trial, is that one of the key prosecutors in that case was William Jennings Bryan, who is of course the Democratic candidate for president in 1896 and several times afterwards, and they. And we look at populism through the spectrum of the Scopes trial to say, oh, the populists were for fundamentalist rural religion. And what they don't realize is that, of course, as you mentioned, Clarence Darrow was the populist in that case in the 1890s, not William Jennings Bryan. And William Jennings Bryan was a Democrat. And the key thing to think about is that in the 1890s, the country was convulsed by debates about evolution, about was the Bible written by God or by men, about comparative religion. There was a great deal of interest in comparative religion in those days. You know, what's the difference between Islam and Christianity, the difference between Buddhism and so forth and so on. So the whole country was convulsed by this, including the churches were convulsed by this, and there was a large section of church members who were moving toward what was then called liberal positions on these questions of evolution and science and comparative religion. And if you look at the populace, they tend to, almost everywhere, line up with the liberals. Far from being in any way conservative, non-thinking Bible thumpers, they tended to be liberals. Many of them came from Protestant churches, learned to read by studying the Bible. But by the 1890s, they are enthusiastic about evolution. They're enthusiastic about comparative religion and understanding how that worked. Many of them are agnostics, like Clarence Darrow was, but a greater number, I would say, were part of a liberal religious movement. And some of that included very exotic things today, like spiritualism and theosophy, which was sort of an Eastern spiritualism. So, but they looked at these as modernizing and liberal religious tendencies, and almost everywhere you look in the populist movement, that's where the religion lay.
We have a caller again here to talk with here in Champaign County. Let's talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I hope I can stay focused here. About researching this, how much of the, I assume, you know, diverse and widely locally published documentation did you go through? I'm also thinking of the bigger press of that era, like the Progressive, which my grandfather was a charter member to, and he recounts seeing William Jennings Bryant and was a little dismayed that he had six, you know, white stallions and a little bit too much wealthy flourish. I guess he thought it wasn't. I think he might have resented the fact that he did sort of split it too. In retrospect, I didn't actually ask him about that as much, but I wanted to know about that, and specifically this particular locally based Illinois Farmer Alliance, or whatever you called it. Is there a way to who's archiving that? I'm thinking about researching the St. Clair County area and see if my grandfather had any. Had any articles in it or something, because he was pretty outspoken. So I sort of methodological a little bit, but I know there's very little time left, so I'll just listen.
All right. Well,
The research, it's there are a lot of ways to look at this movement. One is the documents from the leaders are readily available in libraries. People like Ignatius Donnelly or Clarence Darrow, these type of people, that information is readily available in libraries. The difficult part is what you're saying, is looking at, say, Sinclair County. And the way I would approach that, or way most of my work on that has gone, is by looking at the old farmers' newspapers. Some of those are on microfilm and are available in libraries. Some of them are in libraries, but they're literally falling apart. You know, they're over 100 years old, newspapers that weren't acid-free, and they're dying in those libraries. So I encourage people to go and get them before they're dead. And I think a local historical society may have it. I think that your university will have some of these records. And a way to find them is to read a magazine like Western Rural, which is available on microfilm and is available in Illinois. And you could, from Western Rural, find the names of the newspapers in some place like Sinclair County that would be a good way to track down what you're looking for.
We're coming down to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes left. As a way of trying to come around to a closing point, let me pose this kind of question. I think you encourage people to understand that the people we're talking about, the capital P populists, the people who were involved with the People's Party in the late 19th century, they weren't radical utopians. They weren't anti-capitalists. They were concerned with things like women's rights. They were concerned with corporate power. They were concerned with income inequality. They were not anti-technological. If you ask this question, what kind of vision for America did they have? What kind of country would they like to see America become? What would the answer be?
Canada. Denmark.
Huh.
I'm being a little bit sarcastic there, but they studied closely European and other models, and they liked what they saw. I think that when they looked at the nationalized railroads in Europe, they said that works. I think that the type of country that they wanted was, instead of what was called the free market, or what we call the free market model, which is called the laissez-faire model back then, where corporations have vast power and unregulated control, they wanted a system where there was a larger public sphere, and that sphere would be public ownership of key parts of the economy, whether it's railroads or telegraphs. They also wanted a larger cooperative sphere. They were very interested in an expanded cooperative section of the economy, as well as individual free market economy. So I think you'd call it a mixed economy that would be similar to what you would have in a country like, say, Denmark or maybe even parts of Canada.
Mm-hmm. At its height, how many members could the People's Party claim?
How many members could it claim? That's a difficult question, and I'm not sure that there's a useful number.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the reform organizations at its base, for example, the Farmers Alliance, could claim 1.5 million members, and the Southern Farmers Alliance, 1.5 million members in 1891. I think that the Farmers Mutual Benefit Association of Illinois could claim, 150,000 to 200,000 members. So we're talking maybe a couple million members in these reformer movements that were at the base of this party.
So given that we're talking about 19th century America, I would say that would be a significant number.
It was a significant number. In terms of polling, in much of the West and the South, and much of the Midwest, it's between 10% and 20% of the electorate is voting populist, something like that. And in some states, of course, they are dominating the polls.
You also explained earlier that while the party itself, in a sense, came apart right before 1900, that it was as a party, it certainly was successful, if one of the more successful third parties. But perhaps if you say what was its greatest success, that was that parts of its agenda were taken up by both Republicans and both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party doing, and they did that because they knew they were trying to scoop up populist voters. So they thought, well, if we're going to get these people's votes, we're going to have to embrace some of these issues. But having said that, what would you say would be the lasting sort of impact on America that the populists made? What sort of things do we have now that we can say these folks really are responsible?
Well, they very interesting. There's a whole series of them. But today's world, I would start with the income tax. There's so much politics around the income tax. And we forget that the populists were the first party in America to introduce that as a mainstream political issue. They understood the income tax was essential if there was going to be equitable distribution of wealth in the United States, and they were the first to push that. They pushed flexible currency. I think that they pushed flexible currency hard, and I think the establishment of the Federal Reserve in the early part of the 20th century comes in the wake of their agitation. Those are two really big ones. They pushed, I'm from California, they were the ones who brought into people's consciousness the referendum and the initiative, which you know what terrible trouble that's brought to California. I don't know about the rest of the country, but in California it's a huge issue. It's why the state is slipping into the Pacific Ocean fiscally right now. But they were the ones who introduced what was called direct democracy. I could go on, but those are some of the key reforms that they introduced.
And I think it almost goes without saying that that particular result, say some of the things that have happened as a result of these citizens' initiatives in California, I think if these populists, if we could bring them back today and we could show them the results, they would not be happy.
Oh, they're spinning in their grave looking at California. I mean, they're looking at these people who are saying no taxes for education, and the populists said. It's not even worth eating if we can't raise funds to send our children to school. And our schools in California are closing down because of their 21st century populace with a small p saying no taxes. It's killing our state. And the populace of old would be just dying over this issue.
Well, if people who are listening to us would like to read more about populists with a capital P in late 19th century America, the book to look for is The Populist Vision. It is published now in paperback by the Oxford University Press by our guest, Charles Postol. He's assistant professor of history at San Francisco State University. And Professor Postol, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, first broadcast on July the 9th. We got things a little turned around here, but we will in the second hour be talking about the Sacco and Vanzetti affair, or you'll hear a conversation about that with Moshik Temkin, author of a book on the subject. This was a program we first broadcast in early June, so that's up in the next part of Focus 580. This program, Focus 580, is supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Now, with four area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information available at bodyworkassociates.com. We'll break as we usually do for the markets and news. Stay tuned.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. We're at mid-session at the Chicago Board of Trade and in Kansas City. Contracts are under pressure. In fact, the only contract in green on my screen at the moment is the August soy meal contract, and it's up 30 cents at $3.32.20. Let's go ahead and look at the action in the trading pits in Kansas City. September wheat, 543.5 down 6.5. December, 560 down 6.75. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 508.5. half down 7 3/4. December 5.35 3/4 down 8. September corn 3.18 down 2 1/2. December 3.25 3/4 down 4. March of 2010, 3.38 1/2 down 4 1/4. July 3.56 down 4 3/4.